I would like to now welcome our panelists to the this hopefully enlightening panel. And joining our keynote speakers, Frank Aycock and Adam Powers, we have Robert Ross from Translattice, Peter Rafelson from Rafelson Media, Mike West from Genos Corporation, and Todd Privis from Zinc Render. Peter, Mike, and Todd, why don't you describe your organizations and their relevance to the topic security and reliability issues, and we'll just start with Peter.
Sure. So if any of you were at the great town hall meeting yesterday, I'll just repeat what I said there. My background is in the entertainment production and composing field, primarily out of music. Family roots go back three generations in creators. My great uncle wrote The Jazz Singer, the first film with sound. My father created The Monkees and Jack Nicholson, my godfather, and he created many films and projects. I got into the music business and at a very young age started creating copyrights, titles, assets, and early on advanced into technologies, which took me into the digital asset world. As everything progressed and converged, the issue of 360 degrees of digital rights and assets became an emerging business. And then we were faced, of course, with the prospect of managing all of these assets and metadata and tracking and finding a way to create commerce based on distribution. And as the old model of separation of rights disappeared, we as creators had to get into the business of cloud management, rights, and platform. And that's what DigiRamp, which is my latest baby, emerged from, and how I think I have some relevance here, I hope.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, you've all heard of the Nobel Prize, and you've heard of the X Prize. Well, my company, Genos Corporation, is developing a product, Genos TV, that's taking on the Aycock challenge of creating a total cloud TV system for the United States. It's essentially with the same lineup that you'd see on DirecTV or Dish or Comcast, Time Warner, Cox, et cetera, but taking advantage of infinite channel capacity and also taking advantage of infinite cloud storage, or at least cloud storage that can reach infinite proportions without infinite costs, hopefully. So basically, we're just building a TV system for the 21st century to win the $2 prize for the Aycock challenge, right?
Do I get to hand it out?
Yes, you do.
Good.
Perfect. Todd? Great.
So Zinc is a cloud rendering platform currently running on AWS for visual effects artists and animators. So the process of rendering has been described to us by our clients as like watching paint dry. Typically, when you're setting up a 3D scene and setting up lights, then doing all the computational processing to actually create the final output takes a lot of servers, takes a lot of compute power, and takes a lot of resources. So what we've done is migrate that to the cloud and AWS. So users rendering shots can go ahead and submit jobs directly through our tools and spawn up as many machines as they want to do their job as fast as they want, only paying on an hourly basis. So the idea is to take out the back end of having to spend $250,000 on a server room that maybe gets used once every 4 or 5 months, depending on how many projects you have, and moving that over to an on-demand model running on Amazon right now. To date, we've been in beta for about 3 years. We released about 6 months ago. We've been used to render 7.5 million core hours on Amazon, over 16 feature films, all 400 shots on the Robert Zemeckis Denzel Washington film Flight from Paramount Pictures. All of that was rendered in the cloud on Amazon using Zinc by our client Atomic Fiction. We've been used in about 100 shots in Star Trek Into Darkness, 80 shots in The Lone Ranger, and about 150 shots in the upcoming David O. Russell film, American Hustle. So we are squarely in the content creation space running in the cloud.
Thank you. Now, hopefully everyone, we had three illustrious keynoters, and hopefully everybody listened to the keynotes. So this goes off to everyone. What did you hear in the three keynotes regarding pre-production, production, post-production that would provide the greatest workflow process improvement in the creation of original content. Where's the most value derived from using cloud-based solutions today? And I'm going to start with Frank, and then we'll just...
Well, let me first off say thank you for the opportunity to be here, but also I'm a university professor, and we're in the process, or we're in the job of creating professionals who will be the next generation of those who will be out in the field doing television and radio and all like that. So for me, listening to the keynotes this afternoon, and I'm going to draw just from this afternoon, I will have to say that Adams really spoke to me, because our university has just built a new building. We just moved into it, and we've just really begun to get into exactly what Adam was talking about. And it has been such an improvement for our students and has put them really in the area of North Carolina. Has actually sort of put us almost ahead of where a lot of the television stations are. And so for our students, at least, the whole notion of the things that Adam was talking about certainly falls into that category. And I'm the rest of the others down there along those lines that we're talking about, content creation and all like that, fit right in as well.
So there's a number of benefits. There's a lot of need for the ability to scale out quickly. A lot of people talked about on-demand having bursty capacity where they need to do a lot of computations or something in a short period, and then later on not needed as much. So being able to scale out and scale back down is important. Being able to synchronize organizations from a lot of different places that might have many different services with pieces of metadata in different geographical locations, different offices, that all need to be kept in sync and be telling the same story to the same audience in different places and in different formats at all times.
So I think that there's probably not just one place where cloud's going to make a huge impact on Hollywood, but there's probably a few. One of the ones that V2 has been really intimately involved in at Warner Brothers and Disney and Lionsgate is revolutionizing workflow inside the studios. Traditionally, there's been a lot of silos inside the studios where they don't typically talk to each other, they don't share information. One person in one group wishes they could have access to information in another group. It's really exacerbated by digital, where digital overlaps with home distribution in a lot of studios. They're typically second window, they're competing with syndication, they're trying to figure out ad-based monetization, they're trying to figure out theatrical repurposing, things like that, trying to figure out how to do their windowing, and just getting access to all the information upstream about audience information, how things have played before, has a huge, huge impact for digital, and has a lot of potential for revolutionizing both the amount of content that they can bring to market and effectively repurpose, as well as being able to engage new audiences and build new audiences, which I think is really important as millennials are beginning to define their own path of how they want to define, how they want to consume content.
Thank you. Peter?
So yeah, it's definitely about sharing information and having centralized databases that various divisions of studios and production. But I think there's a larger issue which goes beyond strictly production and that can be disruptive to production, and that has to do with actually legal rights and information that can literally bring to a halt an entire production workflow. I've been in situations, I'll give you one example. I was working on a campaign for Pepsi Max with NFL, Toshiba, Jimmy Kimmel. There were five different sponsors on one spot. And every time we made one single small change, no matter how insignificant, it took days, weeks, and in some cases months to go through numerous biz dev, biz affairs, and legal firms just to finish a stupid 30-second commercial. Had all of the data been logged and easily accessible, and all of the metadata that regarding rights and which frame belonged to whom and concerned whom from the get-go, this could have been done in a fraction of the time. So when we talk about metadata and sharing and logging and centralizing information, a lot of it can be embedded directly into assets through ID3 tags or whatever the metadata is that's actually attached to the, but a lot of it is never even implemented, primarily because You've got one editor uploading all the footage. He knows nothing about what's going on with the chain of title, ownership, legal rights, etc. And then you've got an EP who's working with the director. It's completely fragmented. But if there is a way to at least make room for that, everybody could contribute, and it's all available, whether they want to see it or not, it's there to see.
Which is great, because as opposed to not my job.
Exactly. Exactly right. It's a lot. We're always fixing other people's lack of information.
Yeah, we're just working with I think that's a really good point. We're just working with an entertainment marketing department at a big studio, where they had this exact problem where they would do these 30-second commercials. They go and license Disco Duck or whatever to play in the background of the bad example. Too close to home.
No, I just happen to remember the guy who did that song was the local DJ where I was living at the time he came out with it. So that took me back about 40 years.
You're welcome. they put this music in the background, and literally the legal department of this major, major studio, they have these handwritten notes of what they've been cleared for. We've been cleared to play it online. We've been cleared to play it in a theater. We've been cleared to play it over the radio. We've been cleared to play it everywhere except for the theatrical. The handwritten notes. So every time someone wants to know, hey, I'm going to go distribute this 30-second commercial broadcast television. Do we have the rights? Do we not have the rights? Oh, we had the rights, but they expired 30 days ago. Well, now we need to go relicense it. I mean, keeping track of rights and clearances is a huge mess.
Well, I mean, clearly the plus of all of this cloud computing panacea is the elasticity, right? Nobody wants to keep billion-dollar workstations idle for 95% of the time. So being able to move in and out of resources, whether it's storage, processing, or whatever, is an extraordinary plus. We hear a great deal about metadata as solving a lot of problems. I'm going to take a completely counter view, which I'm sure you'll actually agree with, and you heard some of the problems here. Metadata is just like standards, right? The wonderful thing about standards is the variety they provide, right? Often we get lucky and standards work themselves out, like HD DVD versus Blu-ray or Betamax versus VHS. But in many cases you have GSM, CDMA, and they all survive. Well, the problem with metadata is that it's not like there's a series of boxes and you just tick it. It says owner, and you put Fred. Well, it could also say rights owner. You might put Fred and rights owner. The metadata is not a solution. It's actually a problem unless everybody agrees on a standard for metadata. And that has never happened yet. The final thing, and I think it comes up in everything we did, right from the town hall yesterday, all the way through some of the discussions here and other panels, the legalities here, the legal aspects of what we're doing in this cloud space, particularly as it relates to media, particularly, since that's possibly the oldest technology in this whole mess. The legalities and the law is actually unclear and is lagging by, in some cases, 50 years. So I think we got a really serious set of problems here. I'm all for it. I mean, I love this cloud stuff. It's great. But we got a bunch of problems we got to fix, or this is not going to realize the promise that it needs to realize in the entertainment space.
I would tend to agree with Adam's earlier assertion about the siloed mentality, particularly when it comes to content creation. I can say from a firsthand point of view, the content creation side of things involves moving massive data sets to and from the cloud. And that's just repeated over and over and over with every step of the process, and it generally ends up being really inefficient. There are lots of companies working on different solutions, but there's nothing really tied together. So we've got rendering, there's Avid and Adobe with editorial. There are companies like Colorfront and some of the other encoding people doing transcoding. But every time that process is done, you end up duplicating data and passing data back and forth from the cloud. So I think what would make the most sense and would really go to minimize the workflow and encourage more and more people to move to the cloud over time is a centralized pipeline workflow. So you have files taken in on set at ingest or shortly thereafter, and those are maintained throughout the entire production and creation process, all the way from transcoding to visual effects to editorial to encoding to distribution, and having, again, the metadata in there to make sure everything is tracked accurately, but also having the software developers that are working on these different parts of the pipeline talk to each other and tie in together, so you can actually have a much more efficient workflow and you're not pushing these huge data sets back and forth in every individual step of the process.
And I just want to add that there's no black and white when people talk about studio film business versus independent film business. you'd be astounded at how many independents work on major films. So it's really not a matter of just an all in-house using single system. There are sound guys or videographers who shoot footage as hired guns. They're independent contractors. And they really may not necessarily partake in a highly secure system that a studio wants to control. So you face issues that are also have to do with just the company structure. Who has access to our system? Is it anybody that works on the movie? Do caterers get to log in? And you know, it's there's.
Well, I think Peter, that's good because you're just setting us up for. The next part of this is we've all been listening. So what did you hear in either the keynote or in the answers we've just heard from our fellow panelists about the benefits of applying cloud computing to content creation with which you most disagree and why? Which aspect of collaboration, production, editing, or transcoding is currently the least subject to improvement from cloud computing?
I just want to say that it's the technical assumption. It's the assumption that people are technical. The best, most successful editors I know don't know what a codec is.
Yeah.
I mean, really, they're genius storytellers, and they have guys that work for them. That handle, you know, why doesn't my display turn on? The things that are everybody in this room is very technically savvy, but when you talk about creation and creative versus, you know, cloud compute, anything computing, they don't even want to deal with it, and yet those are the guys that really are hired to do the job that we're talking about.
So we're gonna hold you a second, yeah. And we're gonna let Robert start from Translattice's point of view. Go ahead, Robert.
All right.
Where is it?
So some of the stuff that is most difficult to solve with the current solutions is that, as he was saying, that you know the solutions are all in a technical perspective. And if you don't have the information or you don't have a consistent way of encoding the information or with the metadata problems like we were alluding to earlier, there's many different ways that you could describe a tag or that you could decide to define your metadata schema of how you're going to lay out what this information is and what it means and how does it relate to other information that you have. Those kinds of things, being able to say, well, you know, this content is owned by this rights owner, well, but what agreements do we have with this rights owner, and how do we combine this information in a useful way that we can actually know that these two pieces of information in different places in our system mean the same thing and should be connected in some way that we can use them.
Go ahead, Adam.
So Mike, I'll pick a fight with you, and then I'll buy you a beer later. How about that?
Yeah, perfect. We've done that before.
Yeah. So I think the biggest argument I would have is that the law is really the biggest problem. I think that granted, the laws are antiquated, and you have Mickey Mouse laws.
And we've talked a lot about it over here already. So.
Yeah, where people are lobbying Congress and getting their way out of Congress. But the studios are really, really a complex system. And there's a friend of mine over at Sony Pictures named J.R. Yasker that runs the global metadata management system for them. And she had a really great way of explaining it last week, where she was saying that the studios, people like to look at the studios and assume that they have rights to films, right? Because you talk about them as rights holders and everything like that. They really don't. I mean, they're beholden to guilds, they're beholden to actors and agents, they're beholden to all the different pieces that they pulled together. So it's not like they own something, they can do whatever they want with it. They have existing contracts with MSOs and various MVPDs. I mean, they're really kind of tied down in a million different ways to where their own freedom of action is really, really limited. So thinking of the studios as antiquated or out of touch, or laws that are outdated, I think really runs contrary to the fact that the studios are just kind of burdened with 50 years of legacy, right?
Yeah, precisely.
So that's the only thing I would argue with.
Some cases,
Peter,
are you skipping Peter?
Well, no. I mean, I think we started this discussion of rights and issues, and then of technical ability, and There are many, many, many different parties and sources, and any one asset, whether it's a song, could have as many as nine different interested parties. So it does hearken to ask the question, you know, metadata sharing and centralization. There is no standard, but worse than that, it's a sea of expanding participants that really are involved. There was a time when in the old days, in the legacy days, where you were contracted by a studio. Everything was, in fact, owned by the studio. The publishing, the rights, the acting, every name you see in a film was an employee and for the most part, a tenant of the studio. They lived on the lot. It's
come a long way.
Yeah, it's changing rapidly. Rights definitely a big issue, and I also say that again, creative and technical don't always think the same.
Michael?
Can I ask Peter, was that Eastman Kodak?
Yeah.
Eastman Kodak, okay.
Yeah. And MGM.
Yeah, exactly. I think probably the thing I would reacted to most from the keynotes, actually I'm picking on Frank here again because we are in the same space, at least in our thought process. His vision for 2025, I almost entirely agree with, and he knows that. The one thing that scared me the most was this total disaggregation, right? What his future he was describing was not 900 channels with nothing on, but 100 million programs with nothing on, you know? And 100 million subscriptions to those programs, or at least 10 million subscriptions, which a subscriber would have to go through. So the disaggregation is about the only thing I totally disagree with. On the one hand, you said that all these companies would get brought together, yet the TV and the consumer experience was actually going to get fragmented massively. So I tend to dispute that. I think those conglomerates that form after the current conglomerates die will actually control those assets in a much more manageable fashion. I could see it to the point where the consumer gets all their entertainment and communication and internet and everything on a single bill and a single app to connect them, if you like, rather than 100 million different ways of doing it. But other than that, that's probably what I disagree with most. Everything else I agree with.
Oh.
What he said.
Uh-oh. Okay, Todd, come on. Let's raise it
up. I'd say looking at more towards the technical implementation of things, because that's what we've spent a lot of our time on, and what will and what won't work in the cloud. It's interesting to hear the editorial take on things on how these companies are positioning their cloud services and their offerings. And really, from what I understand, a lot of it's very much locally based. You can't necessarily have an editor working in Australia off media serving in London. And so as far as that goes, I think that's probably the most far off from being efficiently offered on the cloud, the interactive licensing, whether or not it's editorial or it's 3D or it's compositing. I think there are a lot of hurdles that you have to deal with just in terms of latency and having the media locally, whether it's in proxy format or in the case usually of compositing, you're working with full res imagery. I think so it's a twofold issue. You've got the issue of how to actually connect the user to the media and having to keep that within range. Not really necessarily being able to store that far away in a remote cloud environment. And then also looking at the way that these companies are licensing their software now. The major players out there, Avid, Adobe, Autodesk, Apple, all have one way or another say they want to go to the cloud, but I think in their actual move to the cloud is has been very hesitant. I know Adobe's got Creative Cloud, which is essentially a monthly rental program, but the way that we see our business and the way we see the business of a lot of these creative tools is really as a pay-as-you-go usage. So if you're editing for 45 minutes, that's all you'd be paying for that time of a license. So when you look at the major vendors who are selling these software packages from $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000, they want to turn off that revenue stream and go to a strictly on-demand hourly use for these tools that have traditionally been cash cows on their end.
Frank, you've got the last word on this.
First of all, Mike, I'm sorry. I don't think I evidently got my point across to you. Maybe we'll have a beer afterwards, and I'll try to make that point to you. As far as your question goes, we've sort of talked around it, but from my viewpoint, I think that one of the biggest stumbling blocks is probably Congress. Simply because of the fact that we're still operating under a law passed in 1934, we were in the heights of the Depression, at least what I'm talking about the broadcasters are. Heights of the Depression with our first truly socialist president, FDR. And I don't mean that in a negative way, just a quick statement regarding it from historians. But at that time, there was no television, there was no FM radio, there was no cable, there was no satellite, there was no HD TV, there was only AM radio. And we're still operating, the vast majority of that comes from that. The legal considerations are probably the biggest stumbling blocks. I believe that, as I said, there are a number of perils. One of them I mentioned was legal. I do think all of them, or none of them rather, are insurmountable. But I think that the laws that have been passed and the lobbying that goes on and all like that probably is the biggest stumbling block. And to be quite honest with you, this may be a game changer, depending on how it goes. And quite honestly, as a person who's taught media law before, I can't wait to see how this comes out. And yeah, I've got a side that I really want to win, but I'm not going to tell you who it is.
So finally, what can cloud computing end users in content creation or providers of cloud solutions or both groups do together to further advance cloud adoption in this arena? How do we make the most progress here? How do we actually go forward? And why don't we start with Adam?
How did I know I was going to catch that one? That's probably the hardest question to answer, just because there's a great deal for disruption in the ecosystem right now. I think that everyone sees consumers are headed in different directions. I think that there's a lot of operational changes that are going on inside studios right now as digital is on the rise and physical and theatrical are somewhat on the decline. I think that in terms of how do you actually start bringing some of the opportunities to fruition, a lot of it has to do with just open communication, right? I think that the hardest part, just because it's distributed services and one service has to talk to another service and everyone has 30 services knocking at the door, it's like what Mike was saying. There's the great thing about standards is there's so many to choose from. Great thing about services is there's so many to choose from. So how do you actually make sure that people are all speaking the same language, are even aware of all the services that are out there that they can actually use, and can make smart decisions about what the interfaces are and how things interact with each other? I think that it's just an end-by-end problem of too many things going on at once. So just a lot of communication that has to happen before it all comes to fruition.
Very good. Peter?
You know, it's interesting. When a company has to justify huge expenses providing hardware, infrastructure, they really don't care much about the early adopters of a technology that may not necessarily pay for their first year of costs. And you know, a practical example would be, and this is actually a question for Todd, if I want to figure out what the heck I'm going to be doing on a project that I'm designing, am I stuck paying to render, but there's nothing I can do offline? Is there a client side software solution? Do I have to be using your servers to figure out what it is that I want to be doing?
No, it's just designed as an extension of local workflow. So before we were available and the cloud was available, people would buy their own servers. They would rent a server. They would run it on their own machine. It might lock up that machine and take all day. But
so it's strictly computing power that you're adding
and
to
license,
their clients.
License management and scalability and right. Then file management.
Yeah. So you know, I guess I would say the one thing that I'd like to see is companies that are cloud providers doing more what software providers do, and that is whether it be trial, whether it be a limited access, whether it be adopt us, and then when you're hooked, well, you'll pay for what you know you can't live without. It's hard to know where to begin if you're a consumer of cloud services and you're being sold something that you've never used.
Mike?
Well, I think with all of these things, I think the biggest problem is never the technology. The technology in this case seems to be so far ahead of Oh, I'm sorry. Technology. No. The problem is never technology. We've got all the technology we need and more. So that's really not what's holding it back. We've got to get our laws and our business practices and our standards at least in order, that it becomes a much more fluid operation. It's not hard to do. Well, actually, it is hard to do, but the technology certainly is not the problem.
I think for us, we'd like to see cloud providers have more interoperability. Certainly, we've looked at other parts of the pipeline, as I mentioned before, and whether it's encoding or editorial or distribution. You know, we're on AWS, we love that, but what if we find a transcoding partner who's great and runs on Rackspace, and how do you share the data between those two? I think, again, at the early stages of cloud computing right now, that's not really been discussed very much, but unless you have every single solution living on one public cloud, it's going to be difficult to integrate those over time.
I've been sitting here thinking about this question, and for me, I guess the best thing would be to make everything simpler to understand. I know when I try to teach this stuff, I know that when I was working on my book, the hardest thing for me to do was begin to understand the jargon. And even when I'm here sometimes, I run into that problem as well because I'm not an engineer or a computer science person. And I think that as we go through all of this, it may be that one of the things that would the help in terms of lines of communication, just as you were saying, it may be that more than just us talking to us is needed. It may be that there are more people out there that we need to get the message out to, but it needs to be gotten out to them in a simpler form. Transcoding and encoding and CAPEX and OPEX and means a lot to everybody in this room, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything to my wife, who has no idea what she talks. She's a speech pathologist. But if you were to, you know, explain to her in very simple terms, you know, she'd be all for it. And I'm not sure that maybe sometimes that, and we're guilty of this in academia too, having a tendency to talk among ourselves in our own lingo without realizing that maybe we're not getting the message out to the bigger audience.
So I think there's a lot of room for improvement with the way that cloud services are used right now. A lot of people talk about it as something that you can use them to scale out quickly and add more capacity. But this also creates problems when there's outages in some kind of major cloud provider. You also need the availability and the ability to have systems that when certain parts of a cloud service or certain instances that you've deployed in the cloud are no longer available, that you still have access to your data and you can continue your business operations unimpeded. And also to have the flexibility to be able to mix and match between different cloud providers, between hardware that you own and hardware that's in the cloud, and to be able to migrate between these things seamlessly without really being locked into any one particular vendor.
Thank you. I know we had a question here. We don't have a lot of time for questions, but we do, I know, have a question here.
Ready?
Oh, okay. Ready.
So, really good conversation and an excellent group
Just
of
handed
people
on.
To talk about how the cloud enhances production. I'm Daniel Kenyon, by the way, with Equilibrium. And my real question is, if this freedom that Mr. Aycock has professed comes to fruition, how is the biggest problem, which is going to be discoverability, going to be enhanced by these methodologies that you guys are talking about today? And I would even include Todd into that component, because I'm aware of virtual story worlds that are now trying to create real-time stories that can then be displayed graphically. So we're not just talking about kind of text-based stories. We're talking about graphic stories that take on the kind of interactive capability of an online game, for instance, and building story worlds. So talk about intellectual property problems. That gets magnified because it becomes real time. So it's really about discoverability, and I'm sure this is a question that Adam and the rest of you will love to answer.
Okay, so
it's all about metadata. right?
The more the better. The more the merrier.
That's simple. Are you done?
Yeah. I only got three words in there.
Those were the three words.
I get paid by the word, right? So
it's interesting how much people. Sorry, I didn't mean. I'll let you go. I don't mean to cut you off. All right. I owe you a beer now too. It's interesting how much time people spend thinking about discoverability. When I was at Rovi, actually, we were doing an M&A process to acquire a discovery and recommendation engine. I personally looked at 150 different companies that said they did some sort of discovery, recommendation engine, personalization, browsing, search engine for the entertainment space. 150 companies. And we went through and we talked to all of them. We looked at the people and the platforms and the technology and kicked the wheels and figured out who their customers were and everything like that. And we ended up buying this company called Media Unbound. We're a brilliant, brilliant team. They need a little bit of funding to really get their product up to par. The first thing they told us when we got them on board was like, oh, it doesn't really matter anyway, because nobody can tell these search engines apart. And it was really true. After they said that, I was like, we should have thought about that ahead of time. I mean, great to have the team on board. But the thing is that if you take Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and whoever else and put them side by side, if a consumer searches for something, they're going to be able to objectively say, this set of search results is better than that set of search results, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the flip side of that is that Netflix is starting to do their analytics, and I really believe in Netflix's model, which is understand who your audience is, what shows they watch, and start producing content for them. Orange is the New Black, House of Cards, things like that. And it's not about discovery at that point. It's more about surfacing, acquiring the right content, and creating the right content to put in front of the right audience.
Okay. And Adam's right, that's basically niche production for a market that you already own. But if I'm not mistaken, you're asking about in a sea of shit everywhere, anytime, every device, and everybody's a producer, how do you even make a mark? Is that what you're...
Right, so post-millennials, right? Talking about millennials, if they're the generation of the day.
There's another generation that's close behind that they're already, you know, they have cell phones in their heads already.
And the Twitter blogosphere mentality is just that everybody's being listened to, and the truth is no one's being listened to. You know, I mean, I hate to say this, but quality actually matters. And really, no matter what marketing or dollars or promotions you have, the strongest to date is going to still be word of mouth. And the I guess the good thing about where things are going is that at least it's leveled the playing field in that people have access to everything. It's just that what's going to stand out. And in my industry, it used to be, hey, if you got 1 million views, you could walk onto any record label and get a deal. And then it was clear that views don't mean anything. It's how many subscribers, followers, and gauging of potential spends do you actually bring to the table. So being noticed is also a matter of what can you bring to the table with the content? What kinds of fans can you provide to, say, a distributor or a studio? And if you follow the money, that's really what it's going to be. Now, you want to get noticed before fans.
You know what? I hate to cut you off, but you can continue this discussion. I'd like everybody to now join us down in the exhibit hall. Talk to our exhibitors, find out why they're here, what they've offered, because they are terrific, and they have helped truly bring this conference together. And then when we reconvene at 3:30, we will all go to the next room for the first session. No? Never mind. I've just been given...
Back here.
When we reconvene at 3:30, we'll all reconvene right here. Okay. So thank you very much. Thank you to our panelists.